Welcome to the 29th Annual Executive War College brought to you by The Dark Report. This year's conference was in beautiful New Orleans, April 30th through May 1st. The title of this presentation is CLIA Laboratory Director Forum. The presenters are John Harrell, President, Lighthouse Laboratory Services, Charlotte, North Carolina, and Lindsay Strotman, Laboratory Director, Lighthouse Laboratory Services, Louisville, Kentucky.
So my name's John Harrell. I'm with Lighthouse Lab Services, and we're going to be facilitating a conversation, hopefully, about CLIA laboratory director issues. So this session is meant to be interactive. We've got a mic that we can bring around for questions. Would love to hear from you guys on what's working, what's not. We'll go through a few of those, but this is meant to be a conversation. The knowledge you walk out of here with today, maybe from the person sitting next to you, you know, we're not coming with answers for all things, but do want to hear from other lab owners, CLIA lab directors, decision makers on challenges you guys might be facing, answers you might have, and more facilitate a conversation about all issues related to CLIA laboratory directors. I'll do a quick introduction of myself and my company, and then I'll have Dr. Strotman do hers as well. So Lighthouse Lab Services, I founded it 20 years ago. We are a medical laboratory consulting firm. We provide CLIA laboratory directors every month to, I think we're about 160 active right now each month of CLIA labs that we oversee or manage with our directors. That number's been up closer to 300 at times during COVID, and one of the things we'll talk about today is a trend that we're seeing in CLIA labs opening and closing. And so we see a lot of these issues, should have seen at least most things, like the State Farm guy, like we've seen a few things, so we know a few things. So we're hoping to bring that to the discussion here today, but we know that you guys are seeing interesting and unique things as well. And I guess I would love to get a little bit of a sense from the audience. Do we have some CLIA laboratory directors in the audience today? Maybe raise your hand if you're a CLIA director. Okay, so we've got quite a few, which is great. And we'd love to hear from you guys in particular on what you're seeing. And we want this session to be focused on you. You're the star of this. This conference has been very focused on the executives and the business side in general. And through conversation with Robert Michel, we felt there was an opportunity to open this up to more of the scientific side of the house and the laboratory director sides, and so that is the attempt here to do. So, I founded the company 20 years ago. We started our CLIA laboratory director program, fractional labor, about probably 14 years ago, and that was out of just realizing that a lot of labs need lab directors. Directors can oversee up to 5 labs. It was hard for them to find one another, and so we just stood in that space to connect CLIA directors and labs. And then there was also a little bit of a need to referee that relationship because CLIA directors, and many of you in the house may get this feeling, it's a little bit fuzzy on where your role starts and stops. And so a lab would often want them to do the clinical validations of their LDTs and things, even though they were a part-time lab director. And so we sort of set some rules around that and tried to provide structure, make sure everybody was getting paid. And that's been really successful for us and something that we really enjoy doing. There's a lot of stuff going on out there in the market right now that's affecting directors, and so we're going to talk about that as well. But I wanted to bring one of our CLIA lab directors that's on staff with us to the conversation because she oversees multiple labs, so I'm going to allow Dr. Strotman to introduce herself too.
Hi, my name is Dr. Strotman. Call me Lindsay from here on out, not formal at all. I am an internal lab director. I oversee 4 labs currently. I also kind of help facilitate some of these other things that John has referred to, some of the validations, a lot of the upcoming regulations, trying to understand that, where the guidance is going to be headed, whether it's FDA, CLIA, CDC, et cetera. We're getting regulated from all sides, as well as, you know, probably I would say even from insurer side of things, trying to understand that, where, you know, typically, as you said, we stay back from the lab director, but I feel like we are getting more and more pulled into that world when we're trying to understand what's required of us or not required of us from the medical necessity standpoint. So I'm really hoping to learn from you all too, as John said, and, you know, I think throughout this conversation, you'll hear a little bit more about my background when I maybe talk more specific about some of my lab's experience.
Sure. And so, you're welcome to raise your hand if you have a question at any point or if you have a comment. We have a mic that we can come to you with, and so we're going to sort of tag team that and make sure that we get to you guys. But I wanted to throw a few like options for conversation on the table here that I'll put up. I would say that we're hoping to not spend the whole session on one thing, and I think the FDA LDT legislation could allow us to do that. We do want to touch that. We do want to hear from you guys, but we want to make sure we get to maybe a few different topics in case there's some other good things out there too. We also put a question in there just on kind of what's working in your lab. I feel like sometimes these conventions in general, lab conventions, I've been doing them for 20 years, tend to be a bit doomsday, and they can leave you flying home feeling like the sky is falling. And so I think we see a lot of great things happening in the laboratory across the country every day. And we'd love to hear from you guys too on what's working and highlight some of those issues and make sure that we leave time for that. So I'll throw a few of these questions out there for conversation, and I apologize, this did not get cut off on my screen, but it does on this projector. Maybe that's why. But one of the most challenging things that you're seeing in your lab, a general question for you guys to start thinking about, and if you have comments on that, feel free to raise your hand. But one of the things I wanted to highlight was this trend that we started seeing and just recognized really for the first time in the last 6 to 8 months, by pulling all the CMS data on CLIA applications, we're at a point where we're seeing the number of CLIA labs closing at an all-time high over the last 30, 40 years, and the number of CLIA labs opening at an all-time low. And it was just a disturbing trend of, you know, labs falling off. We've dug into that data a little bit, and we think that there's some COVID hangover there, right? We're seeing those COVID labs wash out. That could be even a good thing for the industry. There's a lot of groups that came in, maybe weren't doing the best quality work during COVID, and we're starting to see those flush. But we're not also seeing a lot of opens too, right? So that does account for some of the closes, but we're not sure why we're not seeing as many opens. And so one of the first questions I want to throw out there to you guys was if you had a response to that or a thought, what is your sense for the industry? Do you feel like your lab is healthy, that the environment out there is fertile, or are you seeing more headwinds than you maybe have in the past, and have any thoughts on that? So if anybody has any thoughts, would love to hear them, raise your hand, and we'll come around with a microphone. Do you want to run?
Yeah, so maybe it's a consequence of where I work, which is Silicon.
And if you don't mind, just introducing yourself real quick.
Oh, yeah. Heather Williams. I am a consultant for my own business called Gene Between, and I also serve as a COO for a small biotech in Silicon Valley. Like I was saying, a consequence of where I work, a lot of people are more interested in the DTC aspect of pumping, you know, their resources or engaging with our business in that way versus, you know, the insurance landscape. So I'd love to understand if others are experiencing that in terms of where do they devote resources and who they engage with externally.
So her question, a lot of it's, I think, almost a payer question, too, where there's a focus on going to the patient, doing cash pay. I think that's a response a lot if you've been in this industry for a little while and had the challenges of collecting. Being paid cash for every test you run sounds wonderful. It's a whole different market. I think there's a great opportunity in the direct-to-consumer space. When you own the patient relationship, it's really interesting what happens with the laboratory's position in the pipeline. When you have the relationship with a patient and you need to have, say, a physician approve a lab test, you now commoditize that physician down to you pay them, you know, we pay as low as a dollar for a physician to write a laboratory test order sometimes. Sometimes you can get lower than that. Whereas it typically had been the patient went to the physician and then the lab gets paid, you know, 2.5% on average of the healthcare dollars go towards the laboratory. So I think it is a really interesting development and a great move for a laboratory to get into direct-to-consumer where we can have the relationship with the patient. I've seen labs then say, okay, we have the relationship with the patient. We use looped in a physician to get the test ordered, loop in maybe a telemed physician on any kind of counseling afterwards, loop in a pharmaceutical that's treatment for whatever we're able to diagnose. And now the laboratory is in a much better seat to be able to control that. So I can see why they're doing it, but her question is a little bit more on, you know, how do you divide your time on that from a laboratory director? Are you focused on direct-to-consumer offerings? I think there's a lot of home kit collection that comes along with that that maybe needs validation and creates complications. Does anyone else out there do DTC and have any thoughts on that?
I'm Amanda Natalizio. I'm a clinical lab consultant, and I direct part-time 5 labs right now, so I'm full. I would say that we do have most of our clients are interested in direct-to-consumer right now, and mainly that's just because revenue continues to go down. UnitedHealthcare never wants to pay. Most of our labs are molecular. We're molecular specialists. And they're struggling to keep the revenue up. It just overhead is increasing. Your prices of your consumables, service contracts on instruments, everything is going up. Labor's going up. But reimbursements continue to go down. And with MolDX, it's a struggle as well. So labs are either moving states. Everyone's fearful that MolDX is going to come to, I'm in Texas, that it's going to roll out to other states. And now with the FDA coming out to say that they're going to regulate LDTs, which in molecular, most of the testing is LDTs, a lot of these labs they were considering doing direct-to-consumer before so that they could get more cash pay. Now with the FDA, it's going to push, I think, even more labs to go down to the direct consumer, because if they have to go through the FDA anyways, they may as well do direct consumer because they're going through the FDA for that. So the interest has definitely been peaking, and we do have a few labs that either are in development for direct consumer, or it's direct consumer in that it's a collection that's direct consumer, like GI, for example. I do have labs that the physicians will send kits home for them to collect for GI testing for molecular. So I do see that, but many times the labs that are interested in direct consumer, they're still, because of all the regulations around states, with what you can order as a consumer for a test, that there's typically going to be a physician involved anyway. But we have other labs that are sort of in that line that they want to do direct to consumer, but they're essentially just a cash pay, and they have a physician involvement. But the main point I wanted to make was that if the final rule from the FDA on LDTs does go through, and it sounds like it may if it doesn't get held up in courts and overturned, is that if LDTs are going away and that they have to go through FDA approval, then it's just another layer to do direct to consumer. So I see it go that way, and interest is going to go up because of that.
I think you're right. The amount of permutations with different home collection kits and the way that the FDA approval process works, it's going to be very cumbersome or very challenging. And so I guess since we opened up the FDA box, maybe we dive into that, because I'm sure that's probably the topic that people want to talk about most. I'm happy to give a little bit of my thoughts, having digested it, just dropping yesterday what I could. Dr. Straubman, if you want to maybe give a thought or two on your thoughts on FDA, LDT, and then we'll open it up to questions as well.
Yeah, I did want to go ahead and echo your points, sure, too. That's exactly what I'm seeing with the direct-to-consumer. I think as a lab director, since this is the CLIA forum, one of the things that I'm struggling with is you do need another layer of a client relationship. And I'm getting pulled more into those discussions, and it's kind of a newer field, and it's hard to find the people to direct those relationships. Have you had issues with that at all? Again, just are
at
you?
At this point, I've been pushing back,
yeah,
on it, because the labs don't have it yet.
Yeah. Exactly, and that was the one other thing I was going to say, too, is when it comes to the validations, there is some guidance from, like, EUA and stuff, but when it comes to the validations, there isn't, to my knowledge, any the CLSI guidelines or anything for the direct-to-consumer, so it really is difficult, and there are, again, none, like, Class 1 devices for that. Yet, I know that there is some more on the blood side, devices like Tasso and whatnot that are trying to enter into that space, but we are in kind of a gray area now, and without much guidance, it is difficult to bring, to direct those conversations. And I'm having to, even though, again, they need that revenue, stop that train, again, just based on all the things that go into it that I don't think is quite understood from some of the lab mm-hmm. operations side of things. So, go ahead and...
Sure, yeah. So FDA going to oversee LDTs. LDT is what pushes a lab into high complexity often, and that's what often the driving force between a high complexity lab director being needed. What does that mean for those CLIA laboratory directors, right? Is there still a continued need for high complexity labs in general? Is a question that's, I think, unanswered. You have labs going through the FDA approval process. Once they're approved, would those be considered IVD? Would they be mod complexity? If so, would the need for a lab director go away, a high complexity lab director, PhD, MD level? Possibly. Depends on what it looks like. I think not likely. I think more likely that we're going to see that LDTs will be their own thing under FDA and will still need to fall underneath a high complexity laboratory director. And there's going to be revalidations needed whenever changes are made. So I think that's the case, but it's really, who knows? It's what made it an LDT before was that it wasn't FDA approved. So if it is FDA approved, is it an LDT? Maybe we can just start with that one. We'll take these pieces one at a time. If anybody has thoughts on that, sure.
Just a comment on my opinion on moderate complexity versus high complexity. If I'm going to stick with molecular, even NGS workflows. I don't see an NGS workflow or these manual workflows, even if they get approved by the FDA, they're going to be classified as high complexity. I would be very surprised if the FDA is going to classify an NGS workflow, say you do whole exome sequencing, for example. That's going to be high complexity. If it's a manual process, it's not plug and play where you're pipetting 384 well plates, and there's any sort of data interpretation at the end where it's just not the result being fed into the LIMS and being interpreted. I don't see the high complexity directors going away or high complexity labs, at least for the molecular space, as long as it's not molecular labs aren't crushed and that enough companies and big labs push through molecular tests.
Sure, yeah, I agree. It's hard to contemplate it, but there's been some things that have happened that I would not contemplate making sense. And so you never know what's going to happen. We have one more question. It looks like a response in the back there.
And I do agree with you on the high complexity. We can look at a lot of things that are already approved, like MALDI-TOF, that are high complexity right now that do have 510K approval. So I agree from that.
That's true. Yeah, there is a precedent set for high complexity that is FDA approved. If you don't mind introducing yourself to when you...
Will Finn. I'm with the Joint Venture Hospital Labs in Michigan. Until last year, I was a CLIA lab director for many years. But are we sure we're not conflating complexity with risk? Because FDA is not in the complexity business. They're in the risk business. So I think they have informed us, essentially, that they're not going to assign any LDTs as high risk. But I think CLIA would still... call all of these high complexity, correct?
So I think the question, it's like a puzzle wrapped in enigma. What's that quote? Like so the way that something became defined as an LDT and became high complexity previously was that it was not FDA approved. And so once you are FDA approved, it's like a snake eating its tail, kind of like, is it high complexity or is it an LDT? I think so.
I think it's moderate risk as soon as you approve it.
Sure, but yeah, FDA, risk, I feel like, is almost a separate category. Yeah,
it is separate. Yeah. And I think there are plenty of FDA-cleared kits that are still considered high complexity, correct? Yeah. So
I think hopefully that will continue to exist. I think there's a lot of reasons that should.
Yeah, and if you're not familiar with it, there is a guidance document by the FDA to help categorize. And essentially, as we all know, we're regulated by three government agencies. And so CLIA does have their eight, how they're going to essentially quantify high complexity, moderate complexity, and FDA does work with them to establish that. And as you all know, you can look at the CLIA database and see all that. Before we open for more FDA, I just wanted to give kind of my take so far on it. I've been in the field essentially since the I guess the guidance are proposed back in 2010 on the LDT. So I've kind of lived in this gray area for most of my career. And so I do welcome some clarity there. I mean, I know there are a lot of options to reforming that have been proposed, gone through Congress, et cetera. But I do would like to push to try to, again, make the area so not so opaque and gray for businesses to be able to make decisions that they know aren't going to change in, you know, 2 years, 3 years. So I do welcome it from that perspective. Also, as high complexity, I've seen the gamut for validations and stuff. So I would like to see more uniformity there. I do like that when I've worked with the FDA in the past, they do work with you. I am able to have conversations and stuff, and I do think that will be coming up here with some guidance documents and stuff. But I do want to move from this gray area. Again, I don't know if this is the way to go. Again, there's going to be the legal challenges and stuff, but just from a lab director's standpoint, that is maybe the one like positive note I do want to ring is we've been living in this, and it has been really hard to make decisions in that realm. So
sure. Yeah, I think clarity is terrible lack of clarity is terrible for business, and it's really hard to make decisions when you're in a space where things are really gray. So I think everybody probably welcomes that. I think people, even most lab directors I've talked to, have welcomed, you know, more stringent standards on a validation, not a problem. I think what there's pushback against is the solution or the implementation of this being so heavy-handed and bureaucratic and slow-moving and expensive that it's going to be crushing for small labs. Would like to open that up. Do you feel like this FDA overseeing LDT is going to be good for your lab, or is it going to be harmful, if anybody wants to comment on that? Because maybe there's more views than I'm redacting it to.
I think the question is, do you think your lab would be able to go through that process?
Yeah. Does anybody feel that this is a major threat to their laboratory continuing to do business?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, does it say yeah? Does anyone think they're going to be able to go through this process, I guess is the question. Yeah.
Yeah. So it seems like sentiment, which is what I thought too, is that this is going to be really challenging to get through, to get to the other side of. The implications of that, probably potentially some consolidation in the market where bigger labs that are able to afford this are able to go through the process. Sample volume kind of gets sent and consolidated to those laboratories. Looks like we have a comment there too about a concern. Go ahead.
Yeah, Nick Lancia, Gulf Coast pathologist. I think the concern for us is, as usual, the net benefit is near zero, and the amount of effort that they're going to require us to put forth just to maintain our current, not to add new tests, just to maintain our current test menu, is either going to be completely, you know, untenable, or potentially something that could cause us to go into the red and be there for years. Again, for what benefit exactly, I think is the question. If you could show us, you know, hey, if you go through the FDA approval process and you get your LDTs approved and you get better payment from CMS, maybe that would be worth it. Mm-hmm. But when you give no carrot and all stick, it's kind of a setup to get pushback, especially we know that there's a lot of labs that aren't compliant, and they seem to be doing just fine. So there's that happening, right? So you're not even effectively regulating the market as is, and now you're going to throw a blanket compliance on this. You know, it's like you said, it's a bit heavy-handed and bureaucratic in that sense. And for people who aren't in the industry, it makes sense why they would approach it this way, because it's, you know, they just want to kill all the ants with a big hammer. So it's like a one-size-fits-all type of approach, which I think is probably where a lot of the people that are in the industry are pushing back, saying, well, what about this, and what about this other test, and this you know, this variation of our workflow. Every lab has its own workflow and its own, you know, SOPs. So how do you get everybody to get FDA approval? Do they even have the manpower for that? What's the benefit in the end? I mean, there's a lot of what I think are completely valid questions. And then, you know, I've got a lot of friends who aren't in the room that are, you know, medical directors of different CLIA labs, and it's already a bit of there's a fair amount of time spent maintaining compliance already. Mm-hmm. So when I have discussions with them, the net sentiment, which I'm sure you can echo, is for what? what am I doing all this for? Mm-hmm. Is it really patient safety? Is it, you know, is it better lab medicine? Why are we being forced to jump all, you know, through these extra hoops? And so I think if we were able to better answer those questions, we might be able to move the conversation forward. But right now, it just seems like, you know, everyone's being punished for we don't even know what reason.
Mm-hmm. Looks like we've got a response in the back. And Lindsay, if you had any response too.
I completely agree. I'm trying to look on maybe the one net benefit again with the clarity, but I agree. And, you know, talking to a bunch of my labs and, you know, the owners of that, it's going to be, there are many paths to get there. As John said, this is going to be very difficult, if not impossible, one again for the regulatory. And I think even with the final rule that came out yesterday, when they're, you know, grandfathering in some tests, they're looking at New York State's regulations and stuff, it's almost like they're contradicting themselves a bunch. So I do, again, like the aspect that I can work with the FDA, but everything is so nebulous, even in that 528-page rule. I mean, enforcement discretion, enforcement. Like, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. And that, again, you know, we're headed towards clarity, but it's still so much that's very frustrating. I think the clarity is the only, again, trying to stay positive thing I can
absolutely harp on. It gives a little structure. One of the things in the rule that was repeated throughout it was the word problematic test. So your for what question, it seems like that's the FDA's thought, at least, is that there's a lot of problematic tests out there. I think they say it like 50 times throughout the document and don't really define it, but they talk about problematic tests. And is it Dr. Borstein in the back, I think,
has
a comment.
Thank you. The question was raised, are there any positives for small labs and LDTs? And I'll be appropriately contrarian. A lot of small labs have invested in programs and lose money. I see many labs have invested in NGS, and the instruments are sitting in the corner. I work as a lab director for a number of labs, and that is an not uncommon scenario. And I see tremendous overcapacity in the labs in mass spec. So I think to the extent that clear LDT rules focuses labs on what is really going to be profitable and what not will actually help smaller labs have focus where they, you know, spent a lot of money on projects that really haven't panned out. And so I also think the larger labs, you know, the brand name labs, the Tempus and Foundation, will all have a pretty straightforward time in dealing with the FDA. But I think any small to mid-sized lab that's dependent on LDTs, it's going to be a tremendous challenge. And just as an estimate, the lab I currently work for, which unfortunately has sold to Quest, and my previous lab previously sold to LabCorp, so I think consolidation is an issue. But I would estimate in my job, say 1% to 5% of our revenue is LDT, and probably 25 to 50% of the director's time was dealt with LDT headaches. And it's not entirely clear if that's a good positive revenue proposition.
Okay. An interesting take on that. Looks like Amanda's got a comment here.
Yeah, I think, too, when we were discussing the lab director's time with compliance on everything, I mean, for me, it's 90% of my job. So
LDT?
Yeah. No, just compliance in general. So adding on top of all this, too. So I just want to...
I'll throw in some comments from a legal standpoint.
Just an intro, that, Charles Dunham, attorney.
Oh, sorry, Charles Dunham, Greenberg Traurig. One of the things that I found interesting commenting on all of the problematic tests and playing off of the concerns of, you know, what are there out there, why are we being subject to this, and I deal with the FDA and medical device side of things outside of, you know, lab industry, but the two things that I find very interesting is the grandfathering piece is positive. Right, that wasn't necessarily the case in the proposed rules, so there's a positive there. However, one of the things, and again from the legal standpoint, is the notion of safe and effectiveness, and be very clear, the FDA repeatedly said this because they've had this enforcement discretion for a very long time, and yet they haven't, well, they did in 2016, 17, and the like, but then they hit pause. This is their way of saying, we are now going to otherwise start to exercise our enforcement discretion more, and we are going to go after those problematic tests, and those who are good actors can rest assured we're okay. You're okay. Rest assured, but two things. Number one, yes, in the future as you develop LDTs and other tests, but number two, as you make modifications to those tests that they may or may not think that are safe and effectiveness and so on and so forth. And I think that's the clarity you were talking about. That's where we always get in the gray, especially our clients in the medical device space, of figuring out, like, when does that modification trigger such that we have to, you know, go and go back. This is, when does that modification such trigger that we have to now go into a whole pre-market approval process? Not just a modification, like a whole new process that we have to stop and we can't. So that's, you know, delaying development and enhancement in the piece. And the other piece of the puzzle is a lot of this of having to go through the 510K may be triggered by a complaint, right? A complaint that otherwise someone says your test failed to do X, Y, or Z, or a negative result, the FDA gets in there and then says, okay, we think we now need you to go to this next stage. We're no longer going to grandfather you. So clarity, but also that gray that I just wanted to highlight those things to think about the positives of the grandfathering and balance and really from a compliance standpoint.
Hey, Charles. I wanted to pick at the thread real quick. Amanda, do you have any other one quick add-on on that?
So I have directed both moderate complexity and high complexity, mainly my main high complexity. But I've found that, in my experience, what keeps me up at night is not my high complexity labs, because I have control over those and I've done the validations and I typically go above and beyond what's the minimum requirement and add additional studies to make sure I'm confident in that LDT and that my staff are very highly trained. Because for a high complexity test, they need to have higher education requirements and training. But my moderate complexity tests with FDA approved, my blood chemistry labs, those are the ones that keep me up because they have the most problems. And it's mainly stemming back because of operational issues and staffing, because they're not as highly qualified of staff running those labs and they're not as good at troubleshooting. And so it's hard for me to even delegate testing personnel, but I can't force the lab owners to spend more on a better candidate to place in that role to deal with troubleshooting. So just because something's going to be approved by the FDA, in my experience, the problems I see in the lab are not due to the test itself. As long as you've thoroughly vetted and validated that test, it stems back to operational issues and staffing issues. And that's my concern. My other comment is that for many of my labs, when they're bringing on new tests for molecular in particular, what I'm advising them to do is before they bring on a new test is to ask the vendor, are you planning to go down the FDA approval route? Because if not, that's a big uncertainty for them. Mm-hmm. That's not guaranteed that test maker is actually going to get through the approval process, but that's a safer bet for them. And that's where I see the labs, not these smaller labs, are not going to be able to afford going through FDA approval. The onus is going to be on all of these assay manufacturers and instrument manufacturers that they go through the FDA process, and it's going to consolidate a lot, but the labs will choose those vendors rather than going through the process themselves is what I predict.
Yeah, just to echo a few of your statements, I've already asked that question for multiple assay manufacturers since last night. To your comment about moderate complexity, when I always go through those interviews, I'm always looking for like a fix-it type personality for the exact same reason you said. And I just want to say that the FDA might consider most of my moderate complexity. I might modify something as far as the storage time, shipping time, because some of those are very tight and it's just not, the logistics just can't happen. So a lot of mine I would even consider are, you know, slightly modified from what the FDA says that would, you know, go ahead and bump it up to an LDT. So that's another thing that I have to deal with all the time in keeping up the staffing too. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll respond to the staffing one, then I want to circle back around to grandfathering, which we touched on, and I think has been one of the more common questions I've got, is like, when does this take effect? Who's grandfathered? Can I just push one through real quick? On the staffing side, there maybe is a silver lining in the sense that as, say, an assay manufacturer was to go through this, it could push down the complexity level of the test to a level where the testing personnel have a lighter load requirement. We do have on our Lighthouse webpage, we went through and we collected the five areas, you know, the clinical consultant, technical supervisor, general supervisor, testing personnel, and medical lab director for every state that has anything specific, as well as the federal standards. And we built a map so you can click on your state and you can see the high complexity standards for all staffing in those roles, the moderate. It was scattered across those state Department of Health pages for all the states that had additional regs. So we kind of collected all into one place. So if you ever need to reference that, hopefully that's helpful. There's a staffing shortage, being able to do more with lower level employees. There's some benefit there, I think, but I don't know if it's going to solve the problem.
That's a double-edged sword, just based on my experience.
It's true, right. And so on the grandfathering, I think that's been one of the bigger questions is, what does that mean? Yesterday they dropped saying we are going to allow some grandfathering, is how I'm reading it at least. That wasn't in the first version. It looks like current LDTs will be grandfathered in. Do they need to already be active? Can you try to get an LDT quickly to market? Is there any more time? Has that already passed? I've heard people say, I think May 7th, I've heard people say the publishing date of the FDA's announcement is the date when it had to be active. Any thoughts out there on the grandfathering parts, whether questions or answers?
Hi, Megan Robertson with Epstein, Becker & Green. So not necessarily an answer to when it goes into effect, but one just point that I know from the legal side we saw when we were reviewing it yesterday was, even if a test is grandfathered, that doesn't necessarily apply to post-market requirements for the LDT. So even if you don't have to go through the pre-market requirements and you're exempt from certain quality systems requirements, certain of FDA's post-market requirements, like medical device reporting, registering and listing, likely still apply. So I think just urging that even though it's great that they added that back in some respects, you still need to kind of look at it from a holistic picture for post-market considerations as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's the way FDA getting a good database too, and I would argue too the quality systems even for those grandfathered are going to need to be met too. So that's going to be a lot for the lab to take on that, you know, is dealing with compliance from a whole nother division. So I would like to see as we move forward trying to remove some of these duplicitous rules and compliance between the two. I don't have much hope, but I would like to see that.
Another piece that's kind of sister to grandfathering is there's a portion of the rule that looks like once you've filed, you'll be able to continue to offer your test while under review, which I think gives a little bit of hope. So you get your paperwork into the FDA, then you'll be able to continue testing or perform that test while you wait, is how I'm reading it. And I'm not sure how quick these are going to be turned around. We're estimating that there'll be greater than 10,000 applications put in to the FDA for LDTs. About 125,000 is the most accurate number I've heard being run right now. I think a lot of those won't go through the process, but greater than 10,000 probably will submit. FDA approved 146 or something last year. So the idea of them processing thousands is hard to contemplate. But the good news might be that once you're in the queue, you're able to continue to operate. And just remembering that you have 3.5 to 4 years before this takes effect, and then you would be able to apply and wait for your application to be reviewed. So we could be talking 5-6 years. You throw in some legal challenges. I know of a few that are already queued up, ready to go, that there's going to probably be a loss of at least a year in there. In the way that the rulemaking works is if FDA was not to hit it in at certain time frames, it rolls a whole another year. And so because of their approval process. So I think that the timeline might stretch quite a bit, and we might be really looking at something that is 6-7 years out before it's really impacting. Of course, it impacts what we need to do now as well. But anybody have any other thoughts on that FDA piece?
Yeah,
real quick.
I just want to add myself. I mean, we can look at the European Union and, you know, what they've been trying to enact, too. That is a less stringent, more the tech cert and the valid act type legislation there. So I do want to point that out if you all haven't been reviewing that. But I will say when we're talking about timeline, as a lab director, I need clarity sooner because that might seem like a lot of time, but it does pass quickly. So I'll be looking for that, you know, them releasing those guidances as quickly as possible if they're going to stick anywhere near that timeline. Other
comments? Let's we're down to just a few minutes left. Let's open it up to what's working in your lab. So I'd love to leave on a positive note and see if we could focus on some sunshine. Yeah. So anybody have anything going on in their laboratory that they would like to share? Let's do one more question. Yeah.
Sorry, Rebecca Hancast from Clinical Reference Laboratory. Just touching on the New York piece, so I didn't read the whole rule, but I did read that some of the New York tests will be grandfathered in, and that raises a whole other section of what needs clarity. So my laboratory, we do hold New York licenses, and we've had dozens and dozens of tests, primarily toxicology confirmation testing, approved through New York. So would all of those tests that were like approved under exemption also count? And would tests that New York rated as low risk, meaning we didn't have to submit full validation, would those be grandfathered in? And moving forward, does, you know, future New York approval also confer the FDA? So a lot, I think, more clarification.
Yeah, really interesting comment. Because then you have this pathway that if you could get through New York, maybe everybody quickly files there and you're able to
circumvent.
Right,
you kind of backdoor your way into it.
Yeah.
New York
takes a while. Yeah, not that they're quick, but they might be quicker. I think we've normally seen about 18 months in New York.
But it's I think that goes to some of what comments. Yeah.
Got another thing.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Mike Kranick from Gulf Coast Pathologists. And one of the things, since we're in the state of Florida, we have the clinical lab personnel law. And the problem that I've had in the past is trying to get employees or certified employees in order to move forward with our production. The success that I've had is most of the time folks with some sort of science degree will come and they'll say, well, I really want to work in the lab. But the problem is that I was teaching at St. Pete College and they've closed that medical lab technologist program. So it's very difficult to get somebody to walk up and say, I have these credentials and so forth. So what I've been doing is getting folks in as on a lab aide level, and which becomes a lab assistant level, which becomes, I want them to sit for the exams, and then just move on up. And that's a real success story for me. I have about three people that I know off the top of my head that graduated with master's in science or a bachelor's degree in science, and now are working in big facilities. So that's a good thing.
Thanks, Mike. So we have a little bright spot there. So it's the staffing solution, creating career pathways, bringing in those bachelor's degree, biology, chemistry, other sciences, maybe coaching them up. They're going to have to start at a less than testing personnel requirement level, I think. But once they're able to get, I think, 6 months of experience, they're able to qualify under CLIA.
I've done something similar. I'm in Kentucky, so it is kind of difficult in some of the rural areas. Bowling Green, which isn't that rural, in South Kentucky, I've had a lot of struggled with that, and I've had similar programs and experience. In fact, some of them even gone back to school after, just, again, wanting that extra for different areas that maybe our lab wasn't specializing in.
Sure. Any other, what's working? Anyone else got something they'd like to share about what they're doing in their laboratory that they're seeing good results from? Oh, there's got to be somebody else.
Yeah.
So, this is the first time I'm new 7 months CLIA director in a big hospital, West Virginia University I am from, big center. So, excellent section directors, chemistry, microbiology, blood bank, so they all handle very well. So I don't have much issues. There are some issues, quality managers, they take care of. There's a lab operation managers. So mine is more of a bringing something new to us, where I can bring the, instead of sending to a reference lab, I can bring those tests. Mm-hmm. So that's my job. So I feel, you know, I'm blessed to have all these people around. So things are working well, even though there are minor issues which should be taken care of.
Sure. Yeah, I think it's a good comment there. We run a national morale survey every year, and we just went through that again. It's still open, actually. And we look at wages across the whole country as well as morale. We look at that by title, by department, by state. So you can say, you know, Blood Bank Supervisor Chicago. How happy are they? What are they making? And one of the comments we see about the negative impact on morale is that they don't feel that they're able to apply their education oftentimes, or they're not given authority to kind of make discretionary decisions inside the laboratory. And I didn't catch your first name again. Sheriff was saying that he really leans on his supervisors and department heads to do their job, right? And that frees him up to focus on bringing new labs to market. It probably empowers those managers. And so I think that's important, too. How do you really work with your team and empower them to own their departments and make those decisions to make your job a little bit easier? Because I think there's probably a tendency to hold on to control. Your name's on the certificate and the results that are going out, and so you want to make sure they're right, which is great, but doesn't mean maybe you need to have your finger in every piece of it. So I think that's great feedback. I think we have time for one more. I'll open it up to comment or question of any kind. Anybody else have anything that they'd like to add before we break?
Positive spin on this grandfathering and New York State approval as a pathway to acceptance. I think that will make existing LDTs and existing labs doing high-value LDTs, it'll give them an immediate competitive advantage because competitors will have a hard time either going through the FDA or going to New York, who's presumably going to have a queue even longer than normal. So I think, you know, people that can survive this, it's an opportunity to grow their existing brand if they don't have to revalidate. And also, you know, on a personal note, it increases the value of New York State licensure rather than diminishes it. So I think that's really actually could be viewed as pretty good news for people that have invested in successful and needed LDT products.
Sure. And I do think as people start, there's going to be a bunch of first movers that want to get ahead of this and start applying. Those predicate tests are going to be able to be pointed to by people in second position, third position. So as you allow other laboratories to go through the process of really getting approval, I think there are going to be ways for labs to submit that and sort of protect it in a box so you can't maybe point to everything that they did. But I think that as more tests get approval, we'll have more to point to, and there'll be less of a load for those of us that come after them. But thank you guys all so much. If we can ever be helpful, let us know, and I appreciate your comments and time today.
This concludes the presentation. Please visit the Executive War College website for details on the 2025 event.